Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. On the 18th of April, in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year, he said to his friend...
You're listening to the voice of Frederick March, reading Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's patriotic narrative, Paul Revere's Ride, a page from this afternoon's edition of Anthology. Fleetwood. Every Sunday at 3, WNBC, in conjunction with the Poetry Center of the YW and YMHA, 92nd Street and Lexington Avenue, brings you Anthology, a selection of readings from poets, past and present, and the music to accompany their poetry. Our guests today, Tamar Cooper and Stanley Tannen, and on records, Frederick March. Several weeks ago, when William Carlos Williams was our guest on Anthology, we were talking before the broadcast, and I asked Dr. Williams what advice he had for today's young poets. He thought for a moment, and then with a mischievous twinkle in his eye, a twinkle you can certainly hear in his voice, he said,
"If you like to eat, if you enjoy eating, do not be a poet. And think that you can make any money in it, because it is very certain that you will not make any money, and if you attempt to, you will degenerate into a certain class of poet whom we all know, and we don't we laugh at their verses, but it is not, there's nothing subtle about it, but there's nothing subtle about eating too. So I advise all young poets to get a job."
Dr. Williams, at 76, is still a practicing physician in Rutherford, New Jersey. Looking for the young poet's viewpoint on this subject, we invited as our first guest this Sunday an attractive young lady named Tamar Cooper, a young lady who is an aspiring actress but also an aspiring poetess. Her thespic talents have been displayed in over 50 TV appearances, on the radio and summer stock. And her poetic talents? Well, let's talk about poetry, Tam. What do you think about Dr. Williams' advice?
Well, I agree with him. I really do.
So you're going to get a steady job, or you have a steady job?
Well, and... let's say acting is my steady job. You forgot to say I was in Cyrano on Broadway.
That's true. Cyrano on Broadway. Miss
yes.
Tamar Cooper in Cyrano de Bergerac on Broadway.
Very poetic.
Indeed. Well, you're primarily an actress then.
That's right. That's my profession.
Uh-huh.
And that's what, of course, actresses always advise actresses to get steady jobs, too. So it seems I'm in a position where everything I want to do, I have to get a steady job at.
Well, perhaps with two sort of unsteady jobs, maybe they'll add up to more or less some sort of a steady job, do you think?
Well, I don't know. How I feel about poetry is that you just can't make a cent on it. I mean, the most famous poets don't make money at their poetry.
That's true, whereas the famous actresses really do, don't they?
They really do.
That's your chance, huh?
Yes.
Well, how long have you been on Broadway, or shall I say, in New York, since you've done what? Only the one play, actually.
I've only been on Broadway once,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Then how long have you been in New York?
A little over 3 years.
And you came from where?
Los Angeles.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
That accounts for the introduction in one of your poems.
Oh, about snow.
Yes.
That I've never seen. Yes. And this January was the first real snow I ever saw.
You liked it, I take it, or you wouldn't have written a poem about it, huh?
Yes. Fascinated me.
Well, you know, we've enjoyed finding out about your two professions. But we'd like to hear some of your poems even more than that, because after all, this is anthology, and our purpose is poetry here. Would you be kind enough to read some of them for us?
Well, I'd love to. They mean a lot to me. Poetry does. My first poem is a short poem. My fears, like black tears, through the years and years, roll down the steeple of my thoughts. Caught, blots joy, the toy. This is the poem I wrote about snow last January. Snow, rows of soiled pebbles, step and slush, rush, 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 even in the hush of snow. Coats wrapped, trapped in the prison of wool upon rubber. We suffer in the snow. Toes turn blue, hands do too, to the tune of the swirl, whirl of those sands of snow. Low it falls, stalls, speeding feet, halts the teeming city into steaming flats that know no snow. Chose roofs overhead instead of that curious, furious falling dandruff we love, we know as snow. The third poem is more or less an exercise in rhythm for myself. The tango played on the mango tree went bang over the heads of Fandango. Please don't tease. It's easy to be queasy when the reason is right, but season is wrong. The song belongs to Chango doing the tango played on the mango tree. Repeat deceit, the leeches beseeches for one more. Tore the door, bored to death, our chest heaves to the tune of the tango played on the mango tree.
Thank you, Tamar Cooper, actress and poetess, reading her own poetry. We'll need you a little later on, though, Tam, so please don't rush off.
Oh, all right.
Picture, if you will, an Italian palazzo during the Renaissance. This is the night of the grand ball, the night when the young duke will announce his betrothal to one of the loveliest and one of the richest maidens in all Milan. Below, the guests await their host. Soft candlelight dances on the jeweled fingers of the lavishly dressed ladies. Their escorts in brocaded satins and velvets drink deeply from golden cups, their laughter mingling with the music from the balcony above. At the top of the long marble staircase, the young duke stands with an emissary recently arrived from his fiancée's father. As they descend, the duke catches his friend's arm for a moment. With a swift motion, he throws aside a heavy curtain, revealing the portrait of a young girl. The emissary catches his breath. The young duke smiles and says,
"That's my last duchess painted on the wall, looking as if she were alive. I call that piece a wonder now. Fra Pandolf's hands worked busily a day, and there she stands. Will please you sit and look at her? I said Fra Pandolf by design, for never read strangers like you that pictured countenance, the depth and passion of its earnest glance. But to myself they turn, since none puts by the curtain I have drawn for you but I, and seem to ask me if they durst how such a glance came there. So not the first of you to turn and ask thus. Sir, 'twas not her husband's presence only called that spot of joy into the duchess' cheek. Perhaps Fra Pandolf chanced to say, her mantle laps over my lady's wrist too much, or paint must never hope to reproduce the faint half flush that dies along her throat. Well, such stuff was courtesy, she thought, and cause enough for calling up that spot of joy. She had a heart, how shall I say, too soon made glad, too easily impressed. She liked whate'er she looked on, and her looks went everywhere. Such was all one. My favorite abreast, the dropping of the sunlight in the west, the bough of cherry some officious fool broke in the orchard for her, the white mule she rode round the terrace. All in each would draw from her alike the approving speech or blush, at least. She thanked men, good, but thanked somehow, I know not how, as if she ranked my gift of a 900-year-old name with anybody's gift. Who'd stoop to blame this sort of trifling? Even had you the skill in speech, which I have not, to make your will quite clear to such as one and say, just this or that in you disgusts me, here you miss or there exceed the mark. And if she let herself be listened so, nor plainly set her wits to yours, forsooth, and made excuse, e'en then would be some stooping. And I choose never to stoop. Oh, sir, she smiled, no doubt, whene'er I passed her. But who passed without much the same smile? This grew. I gave commands. Then all smiles stopped together. There she stands as if alive. I will please you rise. We'll meet the company below then. I repeat, the count your master's known munificence is ample warrant that no just pretense of mine for dowry will be disallowed, though his fair daughter's self, as I avowed at starting, is my object. Nay, we'll go together down, sir. Notice Neptune, taming a seahorse, thought a rarity, which Claus of Innsbruck cast in bronze for me.
If you'd like to leave your plumed hat and poisoned ring there on the table, I'd like our friends to meet you as yourself. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Stanley Tannen, the second of our young guests this afternoon. Stanley, like Tam Cooper, has his eye on the theater, but he also enjoys reading poetry, and when he called and asked us if he could read for us some Sunday afternoon on anthology, we very gratefully accepted. Stanley, let's talk a little about readings in general. Of course, productions like Don Juan in Hell and John Brown's Body have given this almost neglected art a tremendous boost these days. But what sort of readings have you done?
Well, Mr. Fleetwood, the last readings I done were over at Columbia University. There weren't too many. I did a few readings from Charles Dickens' Pickwick Papers and a few readings from the Red Badge of Courage by Stephen Crane. I think this is a wonderful medium. I think it's a wonderful thing that you have this program. I was very glad to be here.
Well, it's nice of you to say all those things. We really weren't questioning you to get kind words out of you, but we never turn them aside, believe me. You mentioned Columbia University. Are you associated with the university?
Well, I was attending the School of General Studies, which is a side branch of the school. Uh-huh. I was in Columbia School.
Were you studying poetry or theater or poetry reading
there? No, just taking a general studies course there.
Uh-huh.
And my hobby was spending some time over at the station.
At the radio station at
yes.
Columbia?
Yes, WKCR, if I can put it in the plug.
Oh, I think so. Inasmuch as the radius of the beam, I believe, from the Columbia University station doesn't go beyond the dorms, I suppose we can risk that competition. Well, you plan to do work essentially in radio or the theater?
Well, my ideal aim is the theater, and any acting, whether on TV, radio, is all wonderful experience and pleasure to do.
The allied arts, in other words.
Yes.
The theater.
Yes, Mr. Fleetwood.
Well, we certainly wish you all the best of luck in the future, Stanley.
Thank you.
Again, we thank you for reading for us this afternoon on Anthology. Under the department marked Letters from Listeners, we've been very remiss, and we're most apologetic. Every week, we've truly tried to find time to thank people such as Gerald Carson, George Daniels, and Isabel Churchick for their very kind and encouraging letters. We've wanted to answer a note from C.H. O'Hara, chairman of the Department of English of Washington Irving High School, on the subject of schedules and other material pertinent to anthology. At the present time, we're not equipped to issue advance notices for anthology. We will, however, try to keep you informed of coming events, and perhaps in the not-too-far future, we'll be able to send out a printed schedule. Monroe Hall writes to tell us that in England, poetry and related programs over the BBC have been a great success. One of our English counterparts is called...
The BBC presents Time for Verse, a poetry notebook edited and produced by Patrick Dickinson. The readers are Marjorie Anderson and John Laurie.
The BBC has very kindly lent us several transcriptions from their series, and we plan to feature them on anthology very soon. The programs deal with all phases of English verse, classic and modern, from poetry of a serious nature to poetry with a lighter touch.
Trees, from the very first, have naturally been used by poets to point a moral. The Atheist and the Acorn is by the 17th century poet Anne, Countess of Winchelsea.
Methinks this world is oddly made, and everything's amiss, a dull, presuming atheist said, as stretched he lay beneath a shade, and instanced it in this. Behold, quoth he, that mighty thing, a pumpkin large and round, is held by but a little string, which upward cannot make it spring or bear it from the ground. Whilst on this oak, a fruit so small, so disproportioned grows, that who with sense surveys this all, this universal casual ball, its ill contrivance knows. My better judgment would have hung that weight upon a tree, and left this mast, thus lightly strung, amongst things that on the surface sprung, and small and feeble be. No more the caviller could say, nor farther faults descry, for as he upwards gazing lay, an acorn, loosened from the stay, fell down upon his eye. The offended part with tears ran o'er, as punished for the sin. Fool, had that bough a pumpkin bore, thy whimsies must have worked no more, nor skull had kept them in.
A card from Bernice Aronson and a request. Tam, one of Miss Aronson's favorite poems is Milton's On His Blindness. I wonder if you'd read it for her and for us.
I'd love to, Fleetwood. When I consider how my light is spent ere half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent, which is death to hide, lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent to serve therewith my Maker, and present my true account, lest he returning chide. Doth God exact day labor, light denied, I fondly ask? But patience, to prevent that murmur, soon replies. God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly. Thousands at his bidding speed and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait.
Thank you, Tam. And don't be a stranger.
Oh, I won't. Oh, before I leave, there's an old Scottish doggerel that I just love. Have we a few seconds?
Always for you, Tam.
Thank you. From bullies and ghosties and long-legged beasties and things that go bump in the night, may the good Lord protect you. Goodbye, Fleetwood.
Goodbye, Tam. Years ago, in Concord Village, there was a growing uneasiness, premonition of coming battle and bloodshed, should the British march against the ill-equipped forces of the so-called revolutionists. Revolutionists we prefer to call American Minutemen. The story of the events preceding that battle are read today by young and old, not only in our history books, but in the beloved poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. On the anniversary of this historic event, we invite you to enjoy those exciting moments once again as Frederick March reads Paul Revere's Ride.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear the midnight ride of Paul Revere. On the 18th of April, in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year, he said to his friend, "If the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the North Church Tower as a signal light. One, if by land, and two, if by sea. And I on the opposite shore will be ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm, for the country folk to be up and to arm." Then he said, "Good night," and with muffled oar silently rode to the Charleston shore. Just as the moon rose over the bay, for swinging wide at her moorings lay the Somerset, British man of war. A phantom ship, with each mast and spar across the moon like a prison bar, and a huge black hulk that was magnified by its own reflection in the tide. Meanwhile, his friend, through alley and street, wanders and watches with eager ears, till in the silence around him, he hears the muster of men at the barrack door, the sound of arms and the tramp of feet, and the measured tread of the grenadiers marching down to their boats on the shore. And he climbed the tower of the old North Church by the wooden stairs, with stealthy tread, to the belfry chamber overhead, and startled the pigeons from their perch on the somber rafters that round him made masses and moving shapes of shade. By the trembling ladder, steep and tall, to the highest window in the wall, where he paused to listen and looked down a moment on the roofs of the town and the moonlight flowing over all. Beneath, in the churchyard, lay the dead in their night encampment on the hill. Wrapped in silence so deep and still that he could hear like a sentinel's tread the watchful night wind as it went creeping along from tent to tent and seeming to whisper, "All is well." A moment only he feels the spell of the place and the hour and the secret dread of the lonely belfry and the dead. For suddenly, all his thoughts are bent on a shadowy something far away where the river widens to meet the bay. A line of black that bends and floats on the rising tide like a bridge of boats. Meanwhile, impatient to mount and ride, booted and spurred, with a heavy stride on the opposite shore walked Paul Revere. Now he patted his horse's side, now gazed at the landscape far and near, then, impetuous, stamped the earth and turned and tightened his saddle girth. But mostly, he watched with eager search the belfry tower of the old North Church, as it rose above the graves on the hill, lonely and spectral and somber and still. And lo, as he looks, on the belfry's height a glimmer, and then a gleam of light. He springs to the saddle. The bridle he turns, but lingers and gazes, till full on his sight a second lamp in the belfry burns. A hurry of hoofs in the village street, a shape in the moonlight, a bulk in the dark, and beneath from the pebbles in passing, a spark struck out by a steed flying fearless and fleet. And that was all. And yet, through the gloom and the light, the fate of a nation was riding that night, and the spark struck out by that steed in his flight kindled the land into flame with its heat. He has left the village and mounted the steep, and beneath him, tranquil and broad and deep, is the Mystic, meeting the ocean tides. And under the alders that skirt its edge, now soft on the sand, now loud on the ledge, is heard the tramp of his steed as he rides. It was 12 by the village clock when he crossed the bridge into Medford town. He heard the crowing of the cock and the barking of the farmer's dog, and felt the damp of the river fog that rises after the sun goes down. It was 1 by the village clock when he galloped into Lexington. He saw the gilded weathercock swim in the moonlight as he passed, and the meeting house windows, black and bare, gaze at him with a spectral glare. as if they already stood aghast at the bloody work they would look upon. It was 2 by the village clock when he came to the bridge in Concord Town. He heard the bleating of the flock and the twitter of birds among the trees, and felt the breath of the morning breeze blowing over the meadows brown. And one was safe and asleep in his bed. Who at the bridge would be first to fall? Who that day would be lying dead, pierced by a British musket ball? You know the rest. In the books, you have read how the British regulars fired and fled. How the farmers gave them ball for ball from behind each fence and farmyard wall. Chasing the redcoats down the lane, then crossing the fields to emerge again under the trees at the turn of the road. And only pausing to fire and load. So, through the night, rode Paul Revere. And so, through the night, went his cry of alarm to every Middlesex village and farm. A cry of defiance and not of fear. A voice in the darkness, a knock at the door, and a word that shall echo forevermore. For, born on the night wind of the past, through all our history, to the last, in the hour of darkness and peril and need, the people will waken and listen to hear the hurrying hoofbeats of that steed and the midnight message of Paul Revere.
And so, Anthology number 8. Many thanks to Tamar Cooper for being with us this afternoon, and to Stanley Tannen, too, who was our other guest of the afternoon. Next week, we promise you a rare listening treat. On Monday, April 24th, Harper and Brothers will publish Mine the Harvest, a selection from the last poems of Edna St. Vincent Millay, which she, at the time of her death, was preparing for publication, together with a few unpublished poems from an earlier period. Next Sunday, April 23rd, excerpts from the new book will be read by the distinguished American author and composer Deems Taylor, who will also tell us some of his own personal experiences with Miss Millay. As another highlight of the program, you will hear Edna St. Vincent Millay herself reading her own poetry from special records which were broadcast on NBC in 1939. Anthology is brought to you by WNBC in cooperation with the Poetry Center of the YW and YMHA, 92nd Street and Lexington Avenue in Manhattan. John Malcolm Brennan, director. The next important event scheduled at the Poetry Center will be the appearance on Saturday, May 8th of Carson McCullers in a lecture reading concerning the development of her literary career. Remember the date, May 8th. Anthology is produced by Steve White, written and directed by for WNBC by Draper Lewis. Until next Sunday at 3, this is Fleetwood wishing you good luck and good reading.